This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Hello, and with me, Cam Ruslan. Today we have the return of, to a bit of culture after a very long time, BFM's very own Ezra Zide.
Hello, hello.
Hello. And we also have the return of, once upon a time with BFM, now I don't know what she does.
I think she's a mom.
Is she? Okay.
A mom of three, may I add.
That's right.
Yes.
Azura Rahman.
Hello.
But this is a proper return. I'm still in the office, just not in front of a microphone.
That's right. This is Azura's first time back on radio for like a year or so.
Well, you know, it's my first time here in the new BFM studio. It's not so new for you guys, I suppose, but I'm just completely bowled over by the newness and shininess of things and how everything's kind of been a bit more sophisticated. You guys moved on up, right?
Well, you've played your part in making sure everything's all shiny and nice.
Now you know how big my salary was, because you know now, that's why you guys could afford moving here.
That's right.
They got rid of Azura, they got a new studio.
You win some, you lose some.
So, great. So welcome back. We're on the radio right now. And our three topics this week. Topic number one is the civil service. That's sexy. And topic number two is the irrationality of being a football fan.
Mm-hmm.
And finally, topic number three is Marie Kondo.
Yeah.
So with topic number one, the civil service. Now, I don't know about you two, but my father and his father before him were in the civil service.
Mm-hmm.
Are you two? Any civil service backgrounds with your family?
Probably on my mom's side, the parent side of the family, but not so much. Not a deep history with the civil service.
Azura?
My grandfather was, and so was my mother-in-law.
Right, right.
Yeah.
And I think that, you know, you go around, you'll find a lot of people in this country.
The biggest employer.
And I wanted to look at the civil service and to look actually especially at its roots, the founding fathers of the Malaysian civil service, because I've been doing a lot of work researching on early civil servants in this country, British, but also an underreported community, the Ceylonese.
Right.
Yes. So in the case of the British, being a civil servant in India, in Malaya, and in Africa, wherever, was a real elite. And one of the things in their training, in their background, they would often be, for instance, brothers of other civil servants or sons of previous civil servants. So they have a long history. And in their training, they would have to learn Persian.
Persian.
Wow. Especially if in the Indian civil service, because it was considered to be the sort of like the classical language of the Orient, in the same way that Latin or Greek would be in Europe. And they also, in their schooling, would have learned Latin and Greek.
Right.
So even before here, coming here, and they'd also have to learn the lingo of wherever they were going. So it might be Urdu if they're going up to India, or Pashtun even, and over here, Malay, obviously. And so they were very qualified, and they'd had a desire to come out here. But they were also a complete minority in terms of the wider British society.
Mm.
So if we're talking about Britain now and its Brexit chaos, it's a totally different country, totally different people. And so the British who did come here had some grounding. And
well, they were more global people, I guess, in that context, in terms of the skill sets that they had and the exposure to different groups of people and in the ways in which they interacted with one another.
Yes, I should think so. And also, they had a mandatory retirement at the age of 55. And so they had to go back to Britain. They could not stay here, because it was one of the things that the empire couldn't allow people to witness, people getting old, getting ill, and dying.
Mm. Wow.
So
okay.
You always had this turnover of a sort of like a virile, young crowd, and exclusively male.
I was just going to ask, yes. I mean, isn't that the case? In the beginnings, the origins of civil service, was it all male-oriented?
All male. In fact, you know, if in popular imagination, or if we close our eyes and we try to imagine the past, we don't really think of a female imperial kind of outlook. If we think of wives as being a bit complainy, being rude to the servants. But yeah, it was an entirely male.
The Mem Sahib.
Yeah, exactly.
But of course, you've got the Queen as well at the same time.
Yeah, well, Queen Victoria back then. Yeah, so you had that ultimate sort of mother figure.
Yeah.
But yeah, the actual experience of women on the spot. And so you had also, these British fellas, but you had in tandem with that, because Malaya was one of the newer colonies, but a very old, very established colony was Ceylon. So you had Ceylonese of Dutch burger, Portuguese burger, Sinhala, Tamil, who would come over here and work in, say, the railways, or would be officials in all the various ministries that were happening. And they came as English speakers, and they came essentially as middle class, sort of proto-middle class, an already built middle class. So and even now, the civil service is a pathway to middle classdom, in that you have the prestige, you have a good salary, and you move into middle classness, and that is a cultural package you buy into. And
you say middle class, but then I suppose when they are here, you know, that whole imperialist mindset that you come with, I think they're kind of elevated once they are in the colonies. Don't you think so?
I would say so. And I think that there is a mindset now. We have an enormous civil service in this country. But even so, there is still a sense of it being a prestigious job. It comes with prestige, not necessarily huge amounts of money, but with prestige, good perks.
Security.
And with... Well, just a standing in society.
But also just from hearing everything that Cam shared, it was a wonderful history lesson, but just the gap in which the origins of the civil servants to what, I guess, we experience or perceive of it now. You know, our discussions are always about, you know, how the civil service is bloated and, you know, who is getting into these positions, are the best of the best, you know, representing the country. It seems to have been, well, certainly over time, it's moved a little bit.
Well, see, once upon a time, there was no high finance or big business.
Yeah.
So the job, if you wanted to go, if you were a local, in inverted commas, you wanted to get a job with prestige, it was only the civil service.
Yeah.
You couldn't become the chairman of a bank or anything. It just didn't happen. So I think that there is still this leftover sense of just sort of, I wouldn't call it sleepwalking, but just it's in the DNA now to just go to the civil service because that's the place where a job exists.
A job for life, as a matter of fact, right? A nice pension waiting for you at the end of it.
Full medical benefits, which just doesn't exist in any other job. Producer Ali now is saying that I've run out of time. I've only just begun on the story of the civil service in Malaya.
Yeah, we're still in like the 1800s. Yeah.
but my thing is, it's about still the allure and the security of what the civil service offers, even from what you've just described, Cam. And, you know, I still have family members, especially, you know, those, you know, who, you know, went through government school. And you know, we always talk about, you know, oh, if we get this job... You really hear the sound. There is a huge sense of relief if they make it across that line and become a government servant.
Yeah.
What I want to just kind of focus on is the word service. And, you know, it's a case of it being a vocation. You're serving the people, right? And my grandfather was in the civil service back then. And also when the Brits were here and also when the Japanese occupied Malaya, as a matter of fact. So he was actually serving the Japanese overlord, so to speak. And it was really a case of, you know what, you have to serve the government of the day. And there is a slight nobility in your job in that sense. You know, you're not swayed by political masters, but you're just there to carry out your job to fulfill the needs of the rakyat, so to speak, right?
Sounds very noble, but what if the word service is being read the wrong way around? What if the service is not about serving the people, but the people serving the civil servant? Which I think that if you look at it historically, would be the case, that the British fellows who were here were the tuan.
Yeah.
They were the top of the tree. Mm. And so they spoke the lingo and they were taking care of the people, but they needed that respect coming their way. So anyway, we move on.
All right.
From one extreme to the other, from civil service to the irrationality of being a football fan, Azura. No, obviously Ezra.
Well, that's rather sexist. Why couldn't it be me?
It's not sexist.
Why can't Ezra speak about Marie Kondo and tidying up his house?
Well, you know what? I'll just take on this football thing just for the sake of it. What I want to talk about, it was just a discussion of, you know, me and a fellow friend. We've had lofty ideas about, you know, at some point in time in the future, being old and having two seats at a particular stadium in the UK and saying, you know what, it'd be great to have, you know, at any point in time, season tickets to a pair of seats. And then we went on to a discussion about, but, you know, would it really, why is this this lofty idea? It's quite irrational because only about 6 months ago or a year ago, we were just absolutely miserable because the team sport wasn't doing very well, wasn't playing attractive football. And I was looking into, I guess this particular article says that, you know, it takes I think, twice as much effort or I guess the negative impact when a team loses versus when it actually wins. And I started to think of myself, is there something that I'm looking for in a particular experience for about 90 minutes that I don't get in my day-to-day life? So, you know, the explosion of euphoria or a surprise, and maybe you just need a little dose of that just from a physiological aspect, perhaps. And just to get through the mundaneness. And so actually the idea of supporting it because your father supported you, because I went to university, because that team was being shown, in the 90s on a particular television set, it actually doesn't make much rational sense. But we do envelop ourselves into this entire world, and we spend hours and hours on YouTube watching others feel and talk about the same things.
Well, hours and hours, is it, Ezra?
Well, Jesus. I mean, that's what I've heard.
Can we talk about the team that you support?
Yeah, well, I think it needs to be said. Full disclosure.
I support Manchester United. And of course, in recent days, there's been a huge discussion about the happiness of the players and the fans. And of course, I mean, I love discussing happiness. You know, Plato discussed it, Aristotle discussed it. And sure, Manchester United fans would like to discuss it every now and then. But, you know, actually, a team winning isn't necessarily something that equates to happiness either.
I know. I happen to do the football show on BFM.
Is that right?
That's right, yeah.
Who's your team, Cam?
I don't really have a team.
Okay.
So I think it's interesting because I understand where you're coming from, Ezra,
right.
But I don't have it myself. And there's a reason why I've chosen not to.
But then you gain happiness or some sort of joy or pleasure from, you know, not necessarily putting yourself behind a team per se, but the actual experience of sport.
And I don't want to abandon myself entirely to something over which I have no control.
Yes, it seems that I'm in a bit of a cyclical behavior of a lot of, you know, pain and pleasure, perhaps.
Yeah. Azura, this was your topic originally.
Yes, it was, but you've completely overtaken. But I don't know. Football has always been a pain or pleasure kind of thing, isn't it? I mean, I've never really been a fan of any team, but Manchester United fans seem to rub me up the wrong way with their fanaticism. Sorry, Ezra, I like you. I really do. But, you know,
we've been friends for a while now.
I mean, seriously, the jerseys that you wear, you know, the bedding that you have at home and all that.
Fashion faux pas.
But also that sense of entitlement, because Manchester United happens to be the biggest club in the entire world.
The most commercialised one, yes.
Most commercialised, most successful in English history. English football history.
He's got that on a t-shirt.
And so I don't have that much respect for Manchester United fans because...
Yay. Sure. I'm not thrilled about the fans either on some level. Because
you're different from them?
Don't we all think that we're different from the others?
Because you're a real fan.
No, because not just that. I mean, just a discussion of, you know, I was seeing sort of the unpleasant days of Manchester United in recent months and years. And there was a video of a gentleman who said, you know, I've been going to the stadium for about 50 years and everybody around the club was miserable. And I'm looking at here from Kuala Lumpur. I'm going, oh, this guy actually, he needs this more than I do. He goes to the stadium for, you know, 2 hours, and if he doesn't actually get joy out of it, it's a different level to the bad result I get on a Sunday evening that makes me go into a Monday morning.
Yes,
and I found that quite, you know,
the endorphin rush that Manchester United fans have had for 20 odd years under Sir Alex Ferguson is not matched by fans by any other club.
Right.
So, you know, you're in a privileged position. You want that high to continue forever.
All day, every day.
And you need that, quite frankly, you need the unhappiness to remind you of what happiness is.
And clearly, this is what I'm going through.
How do you know what's paradise if you don't know what's hell, right?
Yeah, yeah.
No, the thing is, I mean, what I find with every single Man United fan that I've come across in the history of, you know, my very short history of 21 years.
I don't know how we got to the Man United thing.
Is that the moment I say, oh, you're a Man United fan. No, I've known them from, like, you know, 1984, you know.
Right.
I've known them when they're like, since they were bad, you know. So they always want to justify their fandom.
Yes.
I agree.
Right?
I agree.
Why is that so, Ezra?
I'm not quite sure. I think it's because...
they're pathetic.
I think it's probably related to the success aspect of it. I have no bones about the success aspect of it, but I'm always curious as to why success has taken place and what were the ingredients. Because the discussion right now, whether at Manchester United or any football fan, is, do you gain joy or is that something that... Because players right now, folks who have, you know, millions and millions of followers on social media, in every interview now, they talk about, there's a a joy and a happiness in the camp, and that has affected our performance. Is joy, you know, that much of something that, you know, impacts fans, those who are involved, and beyond the finance and the success and the trophies of it all?
Absolutely. And it's not relevant, but it's also tribal. The tribal, you are not from Manchester.
Exactly.
Not many Manchester United fans are from Manchester.
I think most of them aren't, as a matter of fact.
That's right.
The real ones probably support Man City instead, right?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, if I have a club that I support, it would be Newcastle United. And it's... And I was watching them the other day, and I don't really know the players too well or anything.
Yeah.
And it did give me a certain joy that I didn't care who the players were.
Right.
And I just wanted them to do well. Right. And that was the first time that I felt a sense of that irrationality of fandom.
Well, someone once said to me that, you know, a football club's not made of great players or great management. It's about the fans. It's the fans that's there every single match, you know, week in, week out. That 12 men, that's the one that really makes the club.
And when I, you know, when you go to these stadiums and you see these fans and you start realizing, you know what, these guys are fans. I'm a casual fan on the side. I might, you know, have...
Do they make you feel small and foolish?
But, well, I'm not a real fan.
Their dedication and religiosity, I guess, it almost astounds me because, you know, to a large degree, I know when and when I'm not affected by performances or results, but these guys are another level. They go, well, maybe this is really something that they really sort of put on a pedestal beyond an idea that I have.
I mean it's all great and everything, but it's not like David Bowie or anything. So we move on.
Let's be real here.
This is the anyway, move on.
Speaking of joy,
In a moment, though, when we return, we're going to be talking about Marie Kondo here on A Bit of Culture on BFM 89.9. And we're back with myself, Cam Rustland, Ezra Zaid, and Azura Rahman, and now the global phenomena that is Marie Kondo.
Oh, Marie Kondo.
Sorry.
I don't know. I mean, I've been watching the Netflix series, and she always introduces herself as Marie Kondo, and the person will say, oh, hi, Marie, and it kind of grates me. But, you know, if... because, you know, why can't you pronounce her name correctly, you know? But, okay, we'll go with Marie for ease of recognition for our listeners out there.
Yeah? So who is she? What does she do?
So she has written 4 books on tidying. I think the first one came out in 2011, and the whole principle, the whole idea behind her philosophy of tidying is about sparking joy. So, you know, so these books had come up first in 2011. And when I first heard about that, because I had friends who were reading, oh my gosh, this is crazy, it's revolutionary. I want to clean out my house.
Do they call it the Con Marie thing?
The Con Marie is a portmanteau.
Ah, right.
Okay. So if you look up the hashtag on Instagram, for example, so you find lots of people who've tidied their homes in a certain way. So I was very reluctant to even read any of the books because I am naturally a very messy person. I'm a sentimental fool. I keep everything, ticket stubs, you know, little dolls from...
That was a bit quick on the ticket stubs there.
Man United stubs.
I collect ticket stubs. I've been doing so since 2002, so I thought it was a personal attack. But anyway,
so
moving on.
A bit of a hoarder, that's me, right? And I don't think that you should just bin things just because. And so, you know, I kind of held off on the whole Con Marie thing. But fast forward to a couple of weeks ago, and she has a Netflix series, and it's about tidying up. So it's produced by Netflix. You know, it features American homes, so couples, families who want to tidy their home for various reasons. One lady had lost her husband 6 months ago, so she just wants to start a new chapter in her life. There were cases where, you know, two guys, they were, you know, students, and then now they've moved on to a home together, and, you know, they want to be adults now. So all kinds of different situations. And when they finally revealed Marie Kondo, you know, in her human form, she's so delightful.
She is, yeah.
She's like a little sprite, you know
what
I mean?
She's adorable, yeah.
And you know, all that feelings that I had about, you know, her being a judgmental, preachy person asking me to bin my books and throw away things, kind of just, you know, just melted away, you know?
Same here.
And she is so welcoming and so understanding, and you want to keep her in your pocket and bring her around kind of thing. And that really sparked something in me to tidy up my own home.
And that's what you've done?
And that's what I've done. You know, I think
Following
her principles. Now, I think the timing is perfect. New year, new you, Chinese New Year around the corner. A lot of people are tidying at the moment. So the real beneficiary of all of this, by the way, this whole flurry of activity is, number one, charity shops. Number two is IKEA because everyone's been flocking to IKEA for organizers. Right. I mean, I've been there 3 times in 1 week, basically, just getting different various organizers for my
cupboards.
That
fit the right size.
The right size. Measure your cupboards first, guys. that's my little tip. But the whole paradigm shift of keeping things that spark joy as opposed to throwing things that you don't find useful anymore. I think that's what really made it for me because before this, I mean, I do tidy up my cupboards every once in a while, but it doesn't last beyond a week before it just kind of melts into a rather, you know, misshapen lump of items. Has always been like, okay, I haven't worn this in 6 months, I'm going to chuck it then, you know. And it's really, how should I say, a despairing process. But in this case, if I have a pair of jeans from 2008, which I don't wear anymore, can barely fit in, but sparks joy when I hold it to my chest and, you know, I'm reminded of all the memories, you know, then I can hold on to that.
Right.
As opposed to buying a top from Zara from 6 months ago and it never really hung well on me, I can chuck that out because, you know, it's never worked for me. So it's kind of, it's a more life-affirming process.
So it's beyond, I guess, the utilitarian purposes of that particular item.
Absolutely. It's not about the utility of an item. It's about how much happiness it brings to you.
So do you hold up one of your children and say, does this one bring me joy?
Now, they are not involved in the process at all because they want to keep, you know, hang on to all of their toys. So I want to do that behind their backs. Yeah. But it's okay.
Well, they're only 4 years old. They'll get over it. They haven't had...
I'll pay for their therapy when they're older. Yeah. But
my first exposure to Marie Kondo was, I think it was one of those TED Talks, and, you know, I also sort of missed out on the books, but sort of listened to these talks, and I remember it being quite almost philosophical about, I guess, her belief systems and I guess, the Japanese culture and approach to items, and I'm wondering if it's just for Netflix or even for the books, it's condensed to this idea of whether it sparks joy or whether it doesn't. And is that what it is?
Well, she's a devout Shinto Buddhist, right. You know, and she's even like served in temples before. And so they have animistic beliefs in that, you know, every item around you has their own innate life. So what she does when she walks into a house, she kind of kneels down first and, you know, kind of takes the vibes and thanks the house first for letting me in. And hence, she does believe that all these items, you need to thank them once you discard them. Say, thank you for, you know, being of service to me. I mean, her method of, you know, sorting out your books, for example, is to give them a tap. And like give them a tap to kind of wake them up. And then when you wake them up, then you realize whether they still spark joy. So, you know, you can see all these Americans in the streets going, what is she doing?
What's
you
going
know,
on
what's
here?
Going on here? Oh, but then they're kind of moved by being Americans. Like, oh, you know, I felt really moved by the whole process.
Yeah, but you're also moved by the process.
Well, I think it's a bit kooky, actually, some bits of it. I mean, like, you want to thank every single item gets kind of boring after a while, to be quite honest with you.
Right. So you saw those Sophie Kinsella books, and
well, that's
it's been a while.
Well, speaking of books, the books is the thing that sort of like raised a bit of hack.
Controversy,
but she's saying you shouldn't have more than 30 books or something.
Yeah, you know, I mean, I think you gotta like pick and choose what works for you. I mean, for example, for sorting out your clothes, she prescribes taking everything out from your cupboards, you know, all the different cupboards that you have under your bed, whatever, and putting in a huge pile and then sorting through, you know, what sparks joy and what doesn't. And
sounds like a weekend.
Do you know what I mean? Yeah. That would have been way too overwhelming for me. So I kind of go by location. So again, with the books, if you love books, hang on to all of them. There's no need
for
you to get
because it does spark joy.
It does. Yeah. It does.
Right. I mean, in some cases, you want to take it one step further. You can, like, you know, throw old photos as well, and I can't do that.
I cannot do that.
You know, so if you can't, don't do it. It's fine.
But I think it has to be said that she comes from Japan, where people have to live in very small spaces, and so you need to have a method for keeping the stuff down.
Yes,
absolutely. You just cannot keep acquiring.
It's a very practical requirement in that sense, and for me, part of the reason why I did it, it's not because I was really running out of space, but I can't find things anymore. And I've kind of like thought I've misplaced things, but I haven't. It's just at the back of the closet. So it's not so much about real estate as me just want to get dressed early,
that's also
in the morning.
Just you getting old and a bit
forgetful. I know, I suppose so. Oh, yeah. You accumulate things as well.
Wow.
I'm just saying.
I'm sure you've got a lot of things hanging about in yours as well.
Anyway, so you... Are you going to keep this up, or is this just a fad?
I have moved on to my dressing table now.
But this is like week one. This is still week one.
You know, I think.
And how long do you think this process is going to take?
It might take me the whole year all I know. You know,
it's a bit of a commitment.
There is a joy, though.
Okay.
In waking up in the morning, opening my cupboards and everything in its little place, and you know, you do want to kind of keep that up, and that's part of the sparking joy process. It's not just about keeping things that you love, but just seeing things, you know, within reach.
You see, here I am patting myself on the back that I make my bed every morning. This
you've done enough.
That's your new year, new you, Ezra.
That was it. Mm. Yeah, you know, yeah. I think there was an admiral in the Navy who talked about, you know, you can get through anything in your exactly. life if you just start by making your bed. And I was starting with that, but I mean, we'll move on to cupboards at some point.
I don't think that I'm a hoarder.
Sure.
Wow, that's a great sentence that can be dissected so many ways.
My wife says that I am, but I think that I'm not. And if I look back on, I mean, I'm over 50 now, but the amount of stuff that I have considering I'm 50, I don't think it's that great. It's not that enormous. And what my principle is, I mean, sure, you know, that ticket stub and that little stone that you picked up once upon a time. If I find it again and I cannot remember where the hell it came from or what its emotional significance was, then it's time for it to go.
So it's useful if you're forgetful then.
Yeah. So my Marie Kondo system is, if I can't remember, it's out. We're going to check back on you in a few months' time.
Okay.
And we're going to see if you've kept it up.
I'll take pictures of my cupboards now.
Please.
And 6 months' time, see whether it's still intact or not.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Terrific stuff.
And I will give it a try. I'll give it a try. What the heck? Because I saw her, and at first I was like, I'm going to hate this woman. But I saw her, and she's so adorable.
She is. You can't hate her.
I thought you were talking about Azura. She's
right
here.
I know,
right
I did for 2 seconds.
No, I was. I'm sorry.
But, you know, I kind of got over it very quickly.
Yeah. Marie Kondo. Right, got it.
Okay.
Got it. So we move on, though. We move on to the final part of the show, recommendations. We recommend something we think might be of interest. And I'm going to go first. My recommendation is actually following it on in many ways from yours, Ezra.
Okay, go on.
The irrationality of it all.
Okay.
It's not a football club by any stretch. It's a cyclist.
Okay.
A professional cyclist. And I find in times of trouble, I'm fascinated by this man called Greg LeMond, who is America's only Tour de France winner. The other two supposed ones have been defrocked, disgraced.
Yeah.
And Greg LeMond is a remarkable guy. And there's this isn't for everyone, obviously, but if there are any people out there who are interested in the sport of cycling,
right?
And it's an amazing sport, quite frankly. I don't go cycling myself because I'm too damn scared.
You value your life way too much.
Yep, and it's hot out there.
Right.
But the sport itself is fascinating. So the book has come out, and I'm really enjoying it. It's called The Comeback. It's by Daniel Devise. And it's about Greg LeMond, who, along the way, he'd won the Tour de France once, and then he got caught in the middle of a hunting accident, and he almost died. He got filled with lead pellets, some of which still remained lodged in his heart. But despite that, he managed to come back and win the Tour de France again.
As one does. Wow.
As one does. And he's a remarkable guy, but a very human person with all the failures and foibles of an actual human being. He's not a heroic person. And so, yes, I don't have a Manchester United, as you have.
Right.
But I have a Greg LeMond.
Fantastic.
Yeah. And your recommendation?
My recommendation, I'm reading a book that I got over the Christmas period called The Course of Love by Alain de Botton.
All right.
And it's about, I guess it's a fiction story, but it's got sort of all of these learnings sort of in between. And it's quite an interesting idea about, because it was sparked off by this piece that Alain de Botton wrote in the New York Times about why you will marry the wrong person. And the entire premise is about, I guess, the influence of romanticism from, you know, yesteryear, from Disney, from everything that we've been surrounded by. And about how, I guess, the idea that if there was a little bit more a realistic expectation of yourself and of your partner, that the experience of togetherness, of the union, is actually much more fulfilling and meaningful, et cetera. So the entire book is sort of trying to sort of go into this trajectory of why it is that we have this notion of love in that way. Was it through an experience when you were a teenager? Was it through, you know, a moment of hurt that took place when you were at the workplace? Whatever it meant, that has somehow shaped sort of your worldview. And he tries to sort of to deconstruct that a little bit.
Wow, heavy stuff.
Okay.
So I see your cyclist, and I see your book on love.
That's right.
I'm going to talk about my label maker. So from highbrow to lowbrow, but it's a recommendation nonetheless. Of course, I've been tidying quite a bit. Fair. And I never thought I'd be that kind of person to put labels on everything. But I found a lot of joy in this little 18 ringgit label maker. I don't know about you, but when I was a teenager, I had a Dymo label maker and I just stuck things.
Absolutely.
Do you know
on
what I mean?
Books.
On my books.
On the textbooks.
Names of my best friends, name of my favorite bands.
Wow.
And, you know, just exactly. And I found one in popular bookstore for 18 ringgit. And it's given me so much fun just kind of going through that punching, you know, kind of motion and just putting random, what do you call it, slogans on this little piece of plastic tape. And I don't know, it's just the joy of seeing something printed. I think it's very childish, but at the same time, it's very real.
And there's a lot of order and symmetry in sort of applying these kind of things, but it just brings order and I guess.
And you're cataloging your life as well, aren't you?
I don't know. I think I just like
made that
punching
sound
little
very
yeah,
boring.
Yeah, exactly.
No,
thank you, Cam.
No, that's a good thing.
I was putting like, you know, life affirming mottos, that kind of thing.
Oh, is it? Oh,
yeah,
okay.
And it's become a toy for me, which my kids can't touch.
Can I ask, does it work in freezers? If you type it out and you put it on a container and it goes in a freezer, does it just fall off or will it stay on? Because I have no idea what those things are in those containers
in
the freezer.
As long as it's a flat surface, you're golden.
Okay. Yeah. Well, that's good. So,
thank you, Azura-chan.
Label maker. Fantastic. That, folks, is why people come to a bit of culture.
A bit of everything.
Yeah. So with that, we come to the end of this week's show. Only remains for me now to thank two special honoured guests, Ezra Zaid.
Thank you very much.
And Azura Rahman.
Thank you.
Fantastic. Great to see you both here. And myself, Cam Raslan. And thank you very much. And please join us next week for another exciting episode of A Bit of Culture here on BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.